Chapter 4. When Captain Aubrey, his steward and coxswain, were at sea, Ashgrove Cottage retained much of its naval quality because of their former shipmates who lived in and around the place, carrying out their usual duties of swabbing, scrubbing, and painting everything in sight in as seamanlike a manner as their age and missing limbs would allow, to the admiration of all housewives within calling or gossiping distance. But the family house, Woolcombe, which Jack had recently inherited, always relapsed into a mere landsman's dwelling. Mrs. Aubrey spent most of her time at Ashgrove, Woolcombe being left in the care of Nason, the hereditary butler, and a few servants on board wages. Yet when Jack was at home, and when there was a good deal of entertaining, particularly polished civilian entertaining, to be done, Nason was brought up to Hampshire, where he had a wretched time of it. He did understand the chief duties of a butler admirably well, caring for the wine in the wood, ulling it, racking it, bottling it, cherishing the bottles, and eventually decanting their contents, bringing the wine to table in excellent condition, and he performed the ornamental part of his functions with proper dignity. But the seamen did not value him a bean for any of his skills. They despised him for his neglect of Woolcombe, which was turned out only once a year in spring instead of every day at dawn, and they resented the least hint of any infringement upon their rights, privileges, or sea-going customs. The sound of one of these disagreements brought Sophie running nimbly to the dining-room on the day of the captain's dinner. As she opened the door, the sound increased quite shockingly. Killick, his disagreeably yellow face now almost white with fury, had Nason in a corner threatening him with a fish slice, and telling him in a high, shrewish screech that he was not all that a good man should be, telling him with such a wealth of detail and such vehement obscenity that Sophie clapped the door behind her in case the children should hear.
"For shame, Killick, for shame!" she cried. "Richie touched my silver!"
replied Killick, his quivering fish slice now pointing to the noble, gleaming spread on the dining table.
"He shifted 3 spoons with his great greasy thumbs, and I've seen him hur on this here slice."
"I was only giving it the butler's rub."
"Butler's—"
began Killick, with renewed fury.
"Hush, Killick," said Sophie. "The Commodore says you are to stand behind his chair in your best blue jacket, and Nason behind him in his plum-coloured coat, and Bondon is to see to the proper gloves. Now hurry along, do. There is not a moment to lose."
There was not, indeed. The invitations had been marked 3:30 for 4, and she knew from long experience of naval punctuality that between 30 and 35 minutes after the hour there would be a sudden flood of guests. She glanced along the table, all ablaze, all exactly squared, rearranged 1 bowl of roses, and hurried off to put on a glorious dress made of the scarlet silk, Jack's present, that had survived its almost intolerably arduous voyage from Batavia unharmed. She was sitting in the drawing-room looking beautiful, and with what she hoped was a convincing appearance of calm, pleasurable anticipation, when Jack led in the first of his captains, William Duff of the Stately, a tall, athletic, exceptionally good-looking man of perhaps 35. He was followed by Tom Pullings and Howard of the Aurora, Thomas of the Unwelcome Thames, Fitton of the Nimble, and presently the tale was complete. Almost complete.
"Where is the doctor?"
she whispered to Killick as he came by with a tray of glasses. He looked quickly about. His face changed from its unnatural expression of amiability with a fixed smirk to its more usual pinched severity, and with a secret nod he hurried out. It was a long-established rule in the Navy that the higher a sailor rose in rank, the later he was fed. As a midshipman, Jack Aubrey, like the ratings, had eaten at noon. When he was made a lieutenant, he and his fellow members of the wardroom mess dined at 1. When he commanded his own ship, he ate 30 minutes, or even a full hour, later. And now that he was, for the time being, a commodore with a squadron, it was thought proper that he should move on towards the admiral's still later hours. But his stomach, like those of his guests, was still a captain's. It had been sharp set before 3. It was ravenous at 3:30, yawning and gaping with hunger. Conversation, though stimulated by Sophie's increasingly anxious efforts, by olives and little biscuits handed on trays by white-gloved blue jackets, by Plymouth gin, Madeira and sherry, was tending to flag, or grow somewhat forced, when the door opened and Stephen made a curiously abrupt entrance, as though propelled from behind. He was in a decent black suit of clothes, his wig was powdered and set square on his head, his white neckcloth was tied with perfect accuracy, so tight that he could scarcely breathe. He still looked somewhat amazed, but recovering in a moment he bowed to the company and hurried over to make his apologies to Sophie.
He had been contemplating on worry angles and had overlooked the time.
"Poor Stephen," said she, smiling in the kindest way. "You must be dreadfully hungry, then."
"Gentlemen,"
she called, rising, to the relief of one and all,
"shall we go in, leaving introductions for later?"
And privately,
"Stephen, gorge yourself with soup and bread. The venison pasty may not be quite the thing."
After the proper hesitations and yielding of precedence at the dining-room door, the table filled quickly, Sophie at one end and Jack at the other. Stephen, as he had been desired, earnestly attacked the soup. A most uncommonly good dish made principally of pounded lobsters, with their carefully shelled claws aswim in the rosy mass, and when the first pangs were assuaged, he gazed about the table. Since this was essentially a social gathering, convoked by Sophie, the seating was unorthodox from the service point of view, though she had respected seniority to the extent of placing William Duff on her husband's right, while on his left he had young Michael Fitton, the son of a former shipmate and close friend. For her own neighbours she had two exceptionally shy officers, Tom Pullings, who had an ugly wound and a countryman's voice, both of which made him uneasy in company, and Carlo of the Orestes, who had no reason for diffidence at all, being well-connected and well-educated, but who nevertheless hated dining out, and who, she felt, needed taking care of. Stephen gazed about. He was not a particularly social animal, a watcher rather than a partaker, but he did like to see his fellows, and quite often he liked to listen to them. On his left there was Captain Duff, talking eagerly to Jack about Bentinck's shrouds. Stephen could detect no sign whatsoever of the tastes attributed to him. Indeed, he could have sworn that Duff would have been most attractive to women. Yet the same, he reflected, might have been said of Achilles. His mind wandered over the varieties of this aspect of sexuality, the comparatively straightforward Mediterranean approach, the very curious molly shops around the inns of court, the sense of furtive guilt and obsession that seemed to increase with every 5 or 10 degrees of northern latitude. On the other side of the table, not directly opposite Stephen but one place up, sat Francis Howard of the Aurora, perhaps the best Greek scholar in the Navy. He had spent 3 happy years in the Eastern Mediterranean collecting inscriptions, and Stephen had hoped to sit next to him. On Howard's right he saw Smith of the Camilla and Michael Fitton, both brown-faced, round-headed, cheerful, intelligent-looking young men of a kind quite usual in the service. They could never have been taken for soldiers. Why did the Navy attract men with round heads? What had the phrenologist Gall to say? Stephen's right-hand neighbour, Captain Thomas, was round-headed too, and deeply tanned, but he was neither young nor cheerful. After a very long career as a commander, chiefly in the West Indies, he had been made post into the Eusebio 32, which was destroyed in the hurricane of 1809, and now he commanded the Thames. He was the oldest man present, and his authoritarian face was set in an expression of disapproval, perpetually cross. He was known in the service as the Purple Emperor.
"Sir," murmured a familiar voice in Stephen's ear, "you've got your sleeve in your dinner."
It was Place, forecastleman, wearing white gloves and a mess servant's jacket.
"Thank you, Joe,"
said Stephen, taking it out and mopping it busily with an anxious look at Killick.
"Capital soup, sir,"
said Duff, smiling at him.
"The true ambrosia, sir, in the right place," said Stephen, "but perhaps a little unctuous on black broadcloth. May I trouble you for a piece of bread? It may do better than my napkin."
They talked away, agreeing very well, and when, after the first remove, a roast loin of veal was put down in front of Stephen, he said,
"Sir, allow me to cut you a piece."
"You are very good, sir. There are few things I dread more than having to carve."
"For you, sir?"
asked Stephen, turning to Thomas.
"If you please," said the Purple Emperor. "Why, you slice as trim as a surgeon."
"But then I am a surgeon, sir, so it is no virtue. The surgeon of the Commodore's flagship. if that is the right expression. My name is Maturin."
Joe Place uttered a loud, coarse laugh, attempted to be smothered with a white kid glove. Stephen and Duff glanced back at him with a smile. Thomas looked furious.
"Oh, indeed," he said. "I had imagined that this was a dinner for commissioned officers, for officers in command,"
and spoke no more.
"Sophie, my dear," said Stephen next morning, "that was a sumptuous feast you gave us. When next I see Father George, I shall have to admit to the sin of greed, of deliberate, premeditated greed. I returned to the venison pasty not once, but three times. So did Captain Duff. We encouraged one another." "I am so glad you enjoyed it," said she, looking upon him fondly. "But how I regret your having to sit next to that cross old stick. Jack says he is always finding fault, always against everything, and like many of those West Indies spit-and-polish captains, he thinks that if he can drive his people so hard that they are able to shift to gallant masts in 13 minutes and make all the brass shine like gold day and night, they must necessarily beat any of the heavy Americans, to say nothing of the Frenchmen. He is going to try to persuade the Admiral to make an exchange."
"If you please, sir, Captain Tom has the dog-cart at the door," said George.
"But he said 9, cried Stephen, bringing out his watch, his beloved Breguet.
Although it was of the perpetual kind, and more reliable than the Bank of England, he shook it twice. The platinum mass that kept it always wound gave a muffled answer, but the hands still said 10 minutes past the hour.
"God's my life," he said. "It is 10 minutes past the hour. Sophie, forgive me. I must run."
As a commander and a post-captain, Jack Aubrey had never discussed the officers of his own ship with Stephen. As a commodore, he had told him about Duff, but rather in the medical line than otherwise. He might also have spoken of the Purple Emperor's shortcomings, since the earlier rule did not apply. Stephen and the Emperor were not messmates, more or less tied by a wardroom loyalty, but it was unlikely that he should do so right away. Tom Pullings had no such inhibitions. He had known Stephen since he was a midshipman, and he had always talked to him without the least restraint.
"That cove should never have risen above master's mate," he said as they drove towards Portsmouth on a sweet morning, talking about last night's dinner and their fellow guests. "He should never have been given authority. He don't know what to do with it, so he is forever giving orders to show that he does. He is always ill-used, always in a rage with someone. You get fathers of families like that. Always someone due for a flogging, or kept to bread and water, or sent to bed for tittering at the wrong moment. It makes life hell for everyone else in the ship, and to judge by his vinegar headpiece, he is not much better for himself. Him and his dignity. Lord Nelson never topped it, the dignified, 'don't talk to me' kind of knob. If you fart on this man's quarterdeck, even to leeward, as is but right, you have insulted the King's representative. Bah! And he has never been in action."
"To be fair, nor have most sea officers."
"No. But he thinks that those that have, hands and all, hold it against him and laugh behind his back, so he takes it out on them as well as everybody else. Now I hope the Commodore will get rid of him. We need a fighting captain in this squadron, not the first lieutenant of a royal yacht with his double black yards. A skipper whose people can fire their guns and who will follow him like the Sophies followed us. God love us, that was a day."
Tom laughed, remembering the tall side of the Spanish 32-gun frigate, and the way he and his 53 shipmates from the 14-gun sloop Sophie had swarmed up it after Jack Aubrey, defeating the 319 Spaniards aboard and carrying their ship a prize into Port Mahon.
"So it was too," said Stephen.
"What is more," said Tom, "the Thames's gunner told our gunner they had not used up even their practice allowance this last 8 months. The guns were rattled in and out now and then, but only in dumb show. And he doubted, he fairly wept when he said so, they could fire 2 broadsides in 5 minutes. Anything for pretty decks and perfect paint."
"Have you anything against Captain Thomas, personally, Commodore?" asked the Admiral. "Do you feel he may possibly lack conduct?"
"Oh, not at all, sir. I have no doubt he is as brave as a..."
"A lion?"
"Just so, thank you, sir, as brave as a lion. But I do feel so strongly that in this squadron, gunnery is of the first importance, and a ship's company capable of firing at least 3 well-directed broadsides in 5 minutes cannot be suddenly improvised."
"What makes you think the Thames cannot do so?"
"Her captain's statements that they have never timed themselves, and her gunner's returns, which show that even the trifling official allowance of powder and shot has not been expended."
"Then you will have all the more to work them up with.
No, Aubrey, I cannot shift the Thames, and you will have to make do with what you possess, which, upon my word, is pretty handsome for a young fellow of your age. I have never seen a ship in better order than the Thames herself, and the Duke of Clarence said the same when he went aboard her at the Nore. In any case, it is not a question of suddenly improvising anything at all. You will probably have several weeks before you are on your station, with the wind so wickedly fixed in the southeast. On the other hand, by way of compensation for taking Pyramus away, I mean to give you the Laurel, and what is more, I mean to give you your sailing date at last. Wind and weather permitting, you will proceed to the rendezvous off the Burlings, specified in your orders, on Wednesday the 14th.
Oh, thank you, sir. Thank you very much. I am most uncommonly obliged to you. And if I may take my leave at once, I shall hurry aboard and set everything in train for Wednesday the 14th.
There is not a moment to lose, said the Admiral, shaking him by the hand.
Pass the word for Dr. Maturin, said the Commodore,
and the word passed down through the echoing decks.
Him and the Commodore have been time mates this many a year, observed a seaman, as it made its way along the orlop.
What's a time mate, Gov? Asked a landsman, newly pressed.
Don't you know what a time mate is, Cully?
Asked the seaman with tolerant scorn. The landsman shook his heavy head. There were already 17,000 things he did not know, and their number increased daily.
"Well, you know what a pigtail is?" asked the seaman, showing his own, a massive queue that reached his buttocks, and speaking loud as to a fool or a foreigner.
The landsman nodded, looking a little more intelligent.
"Which it has to be unplaited, washed on account of the lice, combed and plaited again for muster. And can you do it yourself, behind your back? Not in time for muster, mate. Not in time for kingdom come, neither. So you get a friend, like me and Billy Pitt, to do yours. You sitting on a cheese of wads at your ease, or maybe a bucket turned arsey-versey, and then you do his. For fair's fair, I say. And that is what we call time mates.
I heard of that Billy Pitt of yours, said the landsman, narrowing his eyes.
Presently Stephen pitched upon the right ladder. The ship had at least one more floor than he had remembered, and found the Commodore and the captain of the Bellona in the great cabin. They were smiling, and Jack said,
"Such pleasant news, Stephen. We are to have the Laurel 22, one of the new sixth rates, amazingly quick in stays, and she is commanded by Dick Richards. You remember him, Stephen?"
"The unhappy boy so woefully afflicted with acne that they called him Spotted Dick. Indeed I do, an obstinate case. They're not bad at heart."
"The very man. I taught him gunnery. He laid a pretty chaser, and his gun crews were the best in the ship, the best ship afloat. I had been growing very anxious. I've seen so many squadrons formed, delayed in port, delayed still longer, the date put off again, and then, when their officers had all their stores aboard for, say, a 6 months' voyage, dispersed, the whole scheme given up, the Commodore sent back among the mere post-captains, and reduced to begging in the street, having spent his last guineas on a rear admiral's gold lace."
"When do we sail?"
"Stephen, do not be indiscreet, I beg. French spies may see all the bustle and report it by the countless smugglers. But so long as no one ever mentions the actual date, the ministry feels quite safe. All I can say is that there is not a moment to be lost. You must attend to your medical stores directly, and may the Lord have mercy on your soul."
"Gentlemen," said Stephen to his assistants in their splendid new sick berth, full of light and air, furnished with capacious dispensaries, port and starboard,
"I believe we may now cross off the antimonials, jalap and camphire, the 8 yards of Welsh linen bandage and the 12 yards of finer linen, which sets us up for the first month, barring the tourniquets, the mercury and the small list of alexithymics that Beale is sending over tomorrow. So much for our official supplies. But I have added a certain number of comforts. They are in the cases on the left, together with a chest of portable soup, infinitely superior to the victualling board's second-hand carpenter's glue, and a parcel of my own particular asafoetida. It is imported for me by a Turkey merchant, and as you perhaps have noticed, in spite of the sturgeon's bladder in which it is enclosed, it is by far the most pungent, the most truly fetid variety known to man. For you must know, gentlemen, that when the mariner is dosed, he likes to know that he has been dosed. With 15 grains or even less of this valuable substance scenting him and the very air about him, there can be no doubt of the matter.
and such is the nature of the human mind that he experiences a far greater real benefit than the drug itself would provide were it deprived of its stench. "May I ask, sir, where we are to stow it?"
"Why, Mr. Smith," said Stephen, "I had thought it would scarcely be noticed in the midshipman's berth."
"But we live there too," cried Macaulay. "We live and sleep there, sir."
"You will be astonished to find how quickly it becomes indifferent, how quickly you grow used to what weak minds call the offensive odour, just as you grow accustomed to the motion of the billows. Now this second parcel, colleagues, is a substance more valuable by far than the most nauseous asafoetida, or even perhaps than bark, quicksilver, or opium. It does not yet figure in the London or even in the Dublin pharmacopoeia, but presently it will be written in both, and in that of Edinburgh, in letters of gold." He opened the small, close-woven rush basket, lifted the tissue paper, and then the two layers of pale green silk. The assistants looked attentively at the dried brown leaves within.
"These dried brown leaves, gentlemen," said Stephen, "come from the Peruvian bush Erythroxylon coca. I do not present them as a panacea, but I do assert that they possess very great virtues in cases of melancholia, morbid depression of spirits, whether rational or irrational, and the restless uneasiness of mind that so very often accompanies fever. It brings about an euphoria, a sense of well-being far more lucid, far superior in every way to that produced by opium, and it does so without causing that unhappy addiction we are all so well acquainted with. Admittedly, it does not procure sleep as opium does, a most unhealthy sleep, I may add, but on the other hand, the patient does not require sleep. His mind rests of itself in a remarkable calm clarity."
"Is it in no way dangerous?" asked Smith.
"I heard of no untoward effects in my inquiries among medical men," said Stephen, "though it is known, esteemed, and very generally used throughout Peru. So long as man is man, there is always the possibility of abuse, sure, just as there is with tea, coffee, tobacco, wine, and, of course, ardent spirits among us. But I never heard of an instance in some weeks, or indeed months, residence among the Peruvians."
"Is it prescribed as a specific for some Peruvian disorder, as a tonic, or as an alterative?" asked Macaulay.
"It is certainly used as a febrifuge, and as a remedy for most ills," said Stephen, "but it is primarily taken as an enhancer of daily life, particularly by the labouring classes of men, for as well as the euphoria I have spoken of, the coca also provides, or perhaps I should say, liberates great stores of energy, at the same time doing away with hunger for days on end. I have known thin, spare men, no larger than myself, walk across mountainy country in piercing weather at a great altitude from sunrise to sunset, carrying burdens without fatigue and without food. Yet although the uses of the coca leaf are most evident among the poor, the field labourers, the miners and the porters, they are even more striking among those who work with their heads. I have written all night, covering 43 octavo pages, without mental exhaustion or even weariness after a very hard day's journey, and I have heard well-authenticated reports of surgeons operating for 24 hours on end after a very shocking battle, operating with their abilities undiminished. But from the purely medical point of view, it seems to me that the most evident and immediate application is in everyday mental disturbance. I had great hopes of proving its value in my most recent voyage, but unhappily—I should not say unhappily, of course—all our people, officers, petty officers and seamen were resolutely cheerful. Some frostbites off the Horn, the first hints of scurvy north of the island, but no real depression, no moping, no sadness, no peevish quarrelling, rarely a cross word. It is true that they were buoyed up with thoughts of home, and we had been very fortunate in the matter of prizes, but their merriment among the ice floes of the south, their merriment in the heaving, sticky sea of the doldrums, with the sails hanging loose day after day, would have vexed a saint. Have you any case even approaching melancholia at present?"
"Well, sir," said Smith doubtfully, "a good many of the pressed men are low in their spirits, of course, but as for downright clinical melancholia, I'm sorry to disappoint you, sir."
The young men, who had been bent over the leaves, sprung upright, and Stephen, turning, saw Captain Aubrey walk into the berth.
"Here's glory, upon my word," cried he. "Light and air in God's plenty. It would be a pleasure to be sick in such a place. But come," sniffing right and left, "has something died here?"
"It has not,"
said Stephen. "The odour is that of the Smyrna asafoetida, the most fetid of them all. In former times it was carried hung from the loftiest mast. Perhaps I might be indulged in some oiled silk and a box lapped with lead, in which the bulk may be struck into the porlop, while I keep just a small jar on this floor for our daily use."
"By all means, Doctor," said Jack. "If you will come with me, we can speak to Chips directly. There is a gentleman from the Sick and Hurt Board to see you in the cabin."
The gentleman was not, in fact, from the Sick and Hurt Board, though he carried some of their official papers, but from the Admiralty itself, one of the more rarely seen officials in the Department of Naval Intelligence, a gentleman often entrusted by its chief, Sir Joseph Blaine, with the most delicate missions. Neither acknowledged any former acquaintance, even when Jack had left them alone. Mr. Judd spoke firmly and authoritatively on some obscure points of medical administration, handed over the relevant documents with only the very slightest emphasis, and took his civil but distant leave. Stephen walked straight into the quarter gallery, and there, poised upon the seat of ease, he opened the packet. The papers were straightforward, devoid of interest, their only function being to contain the note that asked him to be in the Beetlewood that afternoon, if he possibly could, or to catch the bearer who would stay at the Cock for half an hour and appoint a very early meeting. At this stage in the Bellona's preparations, Stephen was virtually a free agent. He looked in at the Cock, spoke to his man, took a chaise back to Ashgrove, saddled his mare and rode some miles towards Lys, before branching off into a series of lanes, one of which would have brought him to a farm belonging to Sir Joseph, if, before reaching it, he had not turned along a path leading to the roughest of rough and sandy pasture to a neglected wood, one of the few in England where an entomologist had a reasonable chance of finding that brilliant creature Callosoma sycophanta, as well as no less than three of the tiger beetles.
"I am so glad you were able to come," cried Blaine, reaching up and shaking his hand.
He led horse and rider down to a shaded bank, where Stephen dismounted, tethered Lala by a long symbolic cord, and sat down, contemplating his friend's pale and anxious face.
"I am so full of matter and so disturbed that I hardly know how to begin," said Sir Joseph. "The last time we met I told you that Habachstahl was continuing Ledward's work in sending information to the French, that a threat of retribution was conveyed to him, a threat that checked his activity until he realized how hollow it was. I also told you that he was an exceptionally revengeful man, and that I had reasons for suspecting that he saw me as the ultimate source of the threat. These suspicions were justified, and it grieves me beyond measure, Stephen, to say that he has also identified you as the destroyer of his friends Ledward and Ray, and Clarissa as the source of your information about him, and therefore of mine."
"Do you know how he did so?"
"The first was clear enough. From Ray's known hatred of you and Jack Aubrey and your presence in Pulo Prabang when they were killed. The second was more obscure. But here I must branch off and hark back to that very ugly affair which led to Captain Aubrey's being charged with rigging the stock exchange. It was engineered by criminals, of course, the swell mob, as they say, the same criminals as those who at one or two removes brought about the murder and the disfigurement of the witness whose testimony would have dismissed the accusation. You might think it a far cry from the Solicitor General and a long-established, eminently respectable firm of lawyers to a band of criminals, but the eminently respectable know the less respectable, and so down to the very dregs, and where raison d'état, or what can be disguised as raison d'état, is concerned, I believe that even you would be astonished at what can happen. And I must tell you that by the same long and dirty road, Habachstahl's attorneys had brought him into more or less direct contact with a set of the same kind of fellows, if not the very same. Pratt, who is very well acquainted with that world, asserts that at least three belonged to the former group, and that one of them, a man called Bellerophon, murdered the accomplice who killed and mutilated the unhappy Palmer, in case your wealth might induce him to peach.
Pratt? Said Stephen.
Yes, his acumen, honesty, and very particular qualifications impressed me deeply when you and I employed him, and I have entrusted him with several other inquiries since then, always to the department's satisfaction. He has associates now, all like himself, children of the jail and often former Bow Street runners.
So he told me. He is working for me at present, or more probably two or three of his partners. It is a family investigation. I will tell you about it when we have finished with this.
Sir Joseph bowed and said,
"He did not mention this to me, of course."
But we did talk about you and Captain Aubrey. He has a great respect and liking for you. I might indeed say an affection. However, he paused, gathered his anxious thoughts, and went on. These men, perhaps with the help of some part of officialdom, together with the lowest stratum of crooked attorneys, have presented their employer with the following facts. That you have illegally brought back two unpardoned convicts from New South Wales, Patrick Coleman and Clarissa Harville, now Mrs. Oakes, that you have sought, with me acting as go-between, to have them pardoned, but that since no pardon has yet been obtained, you are still open to prosecution on an undeniable charge that leads not perhaps to death, but at least to imprisonments and loss of all property. Furthermore, they allege that the pardon we sued out for you long ago...
I believe you must explain that, Joseph.
Forgive me, Stephen. When first the department asked your advice on Catalan affairs, it was told that you and some of your friends and relations might have been concerned in the Irish Rising of 1798, which might bring you within the catch-all failure to denounce and association with malefactors legislation. To protect you, we had your name included in one of the wider pardons. I confess that it was a very great liberty, but it served our common cause. Without it, I could not have shown you any confidential document without committing a crime, while at any point a malignant private prosecution might have robbed us of your invaluable help. Private prosecutions are usual in these cases.
Stephen nodded, and presently Blaine went on.
But most unhappily these people appear to have had access to the document, and it is said that it may not be watertight, that if new evidence is produced you may still be taken up for treason. It seems that such evidence can still be procured even now in Dublin, where creatures like the infamous Sir crawl about to this day. Procured at no great price.
In his agitation, Blaine plucked a handkerchief from his pocket, a handkerchief in which there was entangled a sadly folded, crumpled envelope.
"I was forgetting," he cried, holding out the paper. "This should have been sent to you. It is your statement of the amount due to you for the hire of the Surprise in this recent voyage. The accountant disputes your addition on the first page as being too great by 18 pence, and observes that in your grand total you have omitted the agreed sum of £17,000 odd for hire, maintenance, and repairs."
In an undertone, Stephen said,
"How life is diminished when you can forget, or indeed even dismiss, £17,000.
Blaine paid no attention and continued,
"On reflection, I find that I have misstated the case, giving the impression that all this information is in Habakstall's possession. That is not so. He has the general notion, but not the particulars. And from two sources I have learnt that the gang not only mean to make him pay very heavily for them, but then to blackmail him for having procured and used them. I am wholly indifferent to his fate, which is likely to be extremely uncomfortable. I am not to yours, and I must tell you with infinite concern that their more immediate project is to blackmail you. You are known to be wealthy, I am very sorry to say. You are known to be extremely vulnerable, if only because of Clarissa and Padine and the thought of their forced return to New South Wales. The information reached me from two sources. It will not surprise you to learn that Pratt was one, but I think the second will astonish you. Lawrence, Jack Aubrey's counsel in the Stock Exchange case. He was as guarded and discreet as could be, but I gather that Habakstall has begun to find that he is far, far deeper entangled in this association with malefactors than he had expected, that they are not going to be satisfied with the fees agreed upon in the first place, and that whereas the sovereign ruler of even a very small German state can deal expeditiously with awkward customers in his own country, it will not answer here. The foolish man quarrelled with his own lawyer, and now he is consulting right and left for means of protection. And that, directly or indirectly, is how Lawrence has come to understand the matter. He is perfectly aware of the position with regard to Clarissa and Padine. He perfectly understands that the long delays in granting their otherwise routine pardon is part of a long-drawn-out manoeuvre against me, and, through me, against you. He begs you to take the utmost care.
"I have long had a great respect and esteem and liking for Brendan Lawrence," said Stephen, "and I am obliged to him for his kindness. He would not have offered any words of advice at all?"
"He did, indeed, this very morning. They exactly coincide with Pratt, who came to tell me that on Monday a low attorney will at last have the authenticated papers from Newgate to complete the files proving Clarissa's transportation, and with mine, for what it is worth."
Pray let me know what you all think, will you now?"
In the silence a jay pitched in the tree above their heads, a white poplar. It peered down, and seeing what they were, flew off again with a harsh chattering.
"I hesitate to tell you," said Blaine, looking full at Stephen. "It sounds so wild, and I might almost say romantic, excessive. However, we all agree that you should escape at once, taking your protégés with you, and all the money you can lay your hands on. For once the charge against you is laid, once the Newgate records have made their way to the lawyers Habaxthal is now employing, and once he has signed the denunciation that sets the legal process in train, your account with your banking house is attached. You cannot touch it. We think you should hide and remain hidden at least until the Duke of Sussex returns, when my position will be much stronger, and when his kindness for you should make the pardons an ordinary matter of course. He far outweighs Habaxthal in our Byzantium, but in the meantime it all hinges on Habaxthal."
The jay returned, circled round the grazing mare, and perched in the tree once more, grumbling for a while before it flew off again.
"It all hinges on him," said Blaine. "If he were eliminated, he could do no favours, and all this reluctance about pardon would vanish. And the moment they are granted, the blackmailers have no hold on you whatsoever."
He fell silent, but his look conveyed all he meant it to convey.
"Certainly," said Stephen. "He is as much the enemy as Ledwood was, and Ray, and some other men I have killed, or caused to be killed, with a tranquil conscience. But here the case is altered, and with my commitments in this country, I do not think I can consider such a course."
"I suppose not, but I very much regret it, for with the Garter gone, everything collapses. He is the one and only primum mobile. If he were dead, all his revenge and all his influence would die with him. The case is a private prosecution, so it would die too. We should not have to wait for Sussex. I should not have to overcome your reluctance to turn to your old patient Prince William, and the department would be rid of a dangerous opponent, rid for good and all. However, as to money, Lawrence thinks you still have a great deal of it in gold."
"Just so. I consulted him when I was last in town, and after considering what he told me about stocks and shares, annuities and land, I decided to leave it in the little chests that brought it from Spain. One of the partners showed them to me in a vaulted strongroom under their house in the city."
"Would you be prepared to sign a letter of attorney directed to some nominee guaranteed by Lawrence and myself, so that it would be stored in a safe place?"
"I would, too."
"We both thought so, and Lawrence prepared the paper. Here is a pocket inkhorn and a pen. The bank will need some little time to get everything ready, and, you know, there is not a moment to lose.